This podcast was produced by ORFM Dunedin with support from New Zealand On Air.
Nothing can replace the pleasure of turning the pages of the printed book. Join us now as we explore our city's rich literary heritage, talking with people who are passionate about the printed word and celebrating the Dunedin Athenaeum and Mechanics Institute's fascinating local history. Welcome to Wireless Books.
Welcome everyone, and welcome Christine, back to another edition of Wireless Books from the Athenaeum and Mechanics Institute, Dunedin's oldest institution and a library. Tell us more.
Hello, Beth. Well, we've been going almost as long as the city has. We're not as old as the hills, but it feels like it.
It does feel like it today, anyway.
Very cold hills. Shall we start with book reviews? I've got some.
Oh, lovely. And I do see one of my favourite authors, Peter Swanson.
Yes. Now, it's called Nine Lives. Now, the basic thing about Peter Swanson is he never writes the same book twice. Every time it's quite different, except it's a pretty rip-roaring murder mystery.
Oh,
it's
yes,
the only common thread.
Yes, the one continuity is there's a moider. A moider most foul.
Now, he sort of seems to toy with classic genre tropes as well occasionally, and this is the sort of thing you could imagine Agatha Christie tossing off. Nine strangers are each posted a sheet of paper in which nine names are listed, and the only one they recognise is their own, and they're a little bit surprised. Most of them think it's some sort of marketing thing that's gone a bit wrong. They think the computer's gone a bit crazy and just spewed something out and it's been sent out by mistake. But
it does sound very Christie-ish.
Yes, and then one by one they start to be murdered.
Ooh.
Yes. And it starts off... I think he's very obviously somebody who reads and knows what readers are like, because he starts off with a list of the names and a little synopsis of their life. He starts the book with each person receiving their listed names and their various reactions. And just reading through them all, they're all very, very different and all seem to be leading different sorts of lives and different personalities. And there doesn't...
No common denominator?
No.
Or
is there?
Or is there?
Yes. And included in the list of names is Jessica Winslow, who is actually an FBI agent. So she...
Curiouser.
But everybody else has got nothing to do with law enforcement. They're an English professor, a person who owns a resort, a woman who's a kept woman.
A kept woman.
Yes, and, an oncology nurse, a retired business. So they're all different ages as well, a singer-songwriter. And they're all in different parts of the country, like Massachusetts. There's a song about that. Austin, Texas, Los Angeles. So they're just all – someone in Maine, someone in New York. So they're just all –
There's a song about all of them.
Yes.
Ooh.
So, yeah, they're all sort of scattered around – basically, yeah. So, and I started to read it and I thought, oh, I really am enjoying this, and that Beth is going to take it and I won't be able to read it. And the happiness on her face, it makes it even better for you, isn't it, knowing that you're getting a book that I want to read.
Hand it over. Thank you.
And in fact, I've got a second book that actually I want to read even more. It's Anne Cleves. Now,
Anne Cleves.
This isn't a Vera book. In fact, they're calling it the Anne Cleves Classic Crime, and it's a standalone book. And she's been writing for over 30 years now, and at the start she says that this is a book that was published about 30 years ago and it never really went anywhere, and I don't think it even made it out to New Zealand. And she said that you know, readers have sort of picked it. It didn't sell many copies when it was first published, and readers have sort of have picked it up, and because she's become a name in the meantime, it's sort of, but, and it's a standalone and has a detective or two detectives, and she says she's quite fond of them. And I started to read it, and I can see why she's fond of the detective. His name is Peter Porteous, which is sort of a, that's a crime writer's name,
it
isn't it?
Sure is.
And his offsider is, I won't be able to find his offsider now. But anyway, it's a, and it's the sort of book that I love. It's a book where a crime that possibly wasn't even considered a crime at the time is uncovered by the discovery of a body which has been weighted down by an anchor and left in a reservoir, which is a reservoir that was formed only about 10 years before the body's found. But it's a hot summer, and so the reservoir has started to go down. And there's an old dock, not a dock, but a thing that goes way
a pier.
Yeah, but one of those, a small pier. It's just like one for people to walk out on, and the pier actually was taken down because it was in bad condition. But the body had been tied to the end of the pier, and of course the pier's starting to show, and it's discovered by a sports activities place has founded round the lake, which wasn't there when the body was put down. And it's discovered by a woman out canoeing and taking one of the instructors to take an early morning canoe jaunt. And she's gone over to where the pier was, and she would never go there with her pupils because it's a little bit too dangerous and they get into trouble. But she's very experienced, and she just thought, oh, that's interesting, I'll go out and see how much lower the lake level is. And the body is still under the water because it's actually a very deep part, you know, it becomes very deep very quickly. But so she's over it, and she looks down and she can see the corpse. And so she panics, but she calls her fellow instructors, and they call the police, and Peter Porteous is called. Now, I can understand why Anne Cleves liked him, because he's the anti-Rebus. He's a man who likes calm and order, and he hates rushing and getting all hyper, and he thinks that his fellow officers who enjoy, you know, running out into the, jumping into the patrol car and slamming that flashing light on, you know,
blues and twos.
Yes, all that sort of thing. He just finds it a bit childish. So when he's arrived at the office, and he's sitting down reading the reports before he has his 10 o'clock meeting with his staff, and there's a call, and they see there's a body, and he after he makes sure that the officer he's talking to knows not to disturb the scene and not to take the body out of the water, because bodies, once they're been in water, once they've taken out the water, they can just decompose very rapidly. So they want to keep the corpse there until the pathologist can get there. And so he's all this very, very calm and methodical. And then he finishes his cup of coffee and reads the last report on his desk. And then he deigns to go down and to see the scene of the crime. And
it drives me insane.
Well, actually, he had a mental breakdown earlier in his career, and ever since then he's felt that he needs to stay calm and on an even keel. And also his father was insane. He calls him a nutter, and he thinks he might be a nutter. And his father committed suicide by jumping off a bridge at a railway station in front of commuters, which is a pretty horrible thing to do. So, yes. So he's got all these. Yeah, I've read about three chapters of it, and I just thought,
by the way, the title is The Sleeping and the Dead. You became quite carried away. You forgot to give us the title. I do appreciate you bringing it. And to me, next time you may want to practice reading a little quicker than you get through more chapters before you have to bring it in. Oh, and it's in North Devon. Oh, how lovely.
Yeah.
And Devon's going to be lots of beautiful descriptions of the area. as well. Goodness me. Oh, no. Hannah Morton. The news that a body has been found leaves prison officer Hannah Morton in shock. Michael, who I assume was the corpse, had been her boyfriend, and she'd been with him the night he disappeared. And now the discovery is bringing back dreaded and long-buried memories from her past.
Now, the interesting thing about the person that is at the back of the book they claim is the corpse, he was only reported missing 2 years after he was last seen, and it was because his parents died and the estate was trying to contact him. So it was sort of action by lawyers, not so nobody that was close to him actually went to the police at the time and said, my friend or my boyfriend or whatever is missing. So it's this, he's very mysterious.
Oh,
and also, there's two other young men missing at the same around the same time who it possibly could be. So maybe it's not the person you think it is. I don't know. I've only
You've
read,
only
three,
read three chapters, right.
Now, I've got the latest Deborah Chandler book, The Leonard Girls, and this... Chandler has written a lot of books. She's written mostly historical novels. She has a PhD in history, and she's written 17 novels, and she's also written a young adult novel and two non-fiction books. And at the back of in the author's notes, it turns out those two non-fiction books are about the Vietnam War, and this is a book set during the Vietnam War, and it follows the fortunes of two sisters, one who is a nurse and has volunteered to go to Vietnam and serve as an army nurse, and the other one is a student who makes, who's part of an anti-war group, and she also makes a bit of money on the side by being as a folk singer, so she sings in clubs at night time, and she actually ends up going to Vietnam as well as part of the as entertainment. And so Deborah has quite a long author's note at the end where she talks about all the sources that she's gone through to find information about this, and she gives a brief synopsis of the Australian and New Zealand activities or involvement in the Vietnam War, or the American War as the Vietnamese call it. And it's actually very interesting, and she, you know, she quotes sources, not just books, but YouTubes and Facebook pages. You can go and have a look, see if you are interested.
So is Deborah Chaloner an Australian author? Like, where's it?
No, well, she's a New Zealand author, but I think she lives... I think she lives in Australia now. But the thing is, she couldn't find very much written material about the New Zealand nurses' activities, but there's a lot has been written about the Australian nurses. And the New Zealanders and Australians tended to sort of serve together, and they it's quite complicated, and I'm not really a big warhead, but they... The New Zealanders went in platoons or in groups, and they served in a unit, and they stayed together and formed bonds, and so did the Australians. Whereas the Americans tended to be sent out individually. You know, they sort of got moved around a lot more, and it was much more ad hoc. Now, that's my take, but that's probably rubbish, and anybody who knows anything is probably spitting out their coffee and great disgust at me. But anyway, that's what I took from her notes. And also, the entertainment was much more freelance. So we tend to think of entertainers in conflicts as what happened during the Second World War, which was very much controlled by the army. But the people in Vietnam were much more just turning up and putting on a show because there was money to be made. And so they weren't necessarily part of an army unit. And so, and that was the sort of the two areas where women were involved in the conflict as nurses and as entertainers. Mm. And in fact, there was a young Australian entertainer who was murdered on stage by an American GI who was trying to kill his commanding officer, but hit her instead. which is...
Is that in the book or is that true? Sorry, you've lost me.
That's true.
Oh, okay.
So, yeah. So, and...
Tough gig.
Yeah. And she based the touring group on a real group, and they were young men, and two of them had been called up for military service, and so they, bizarrely, they decided to go to Vietnam and operate as independent entertainers rather than stay at home and be conscripted into the army and be sent out to Vietnam to actually fight in the war. So they're quoted as saying, yeah, we ran to a war to get out of a war. Sort of, you know, how strange things can happen in war times. And, yeah. So she's done a lot of research on this, and, yeah, so I think it's pretty a good read.
Yeah, sounds fascinating.
Now, the last one I've got is by Robert Goddard, and it is called This Is the Night They Come for You. And this is actually set in Algiers. And there's a police officer, Talab, who is coming towards retirement, and he's just sort of sitting out his time. And he's a good police officer and an honest man, and he actually loves his job, but he can't show it because everybody else expects him to be just... crossing off the days until he can clear off. And it's all very political because of the changes of government and military coups. And, so Algiers is a very conflicted political situation, and it extends to the police force. And there's a lot of corruption, although he himself is not corrupt. And he's assigned to work with an agent from the country's secret service. She's actually a woman. And they're instructed to pursue a former agent who is now on the run after 20 years in prison for his part in a high-level corruption scandal. And Taleb is actually drawn into this because he was the person who put the guy away in the first place. Although the man that served time is... the smaller of two fish, and the larger fish actually escaped and has been living the high life overseas. Mm-hmm. So Taleb wants to follow the smaller fish because he's hoping that this guy might lead them to the bigger guy that got away in the first place. Mm. And they just start uncovering more and more. And this now Robert Goddard loves doing research, like he did actually two books on the Dreyfus Affair, which were very well received and very well researched. And this is almost more of the same, I think, because there's just so much that happened when France reluctantly gave Algiers its freedom. There were freedom fighters, and there was Algerians in France who demonstrated, and the police chief who actually had been a police chief when the Nazis controlled Paris, basically herded them into the Seine, and a lot of people died. In fact, they don't even know the correct numbers of people. And so at the back, he's got a little glossary of real people that were involved. And this police chief got the perfect of police in Paris at the time of the 1961 massacre of Algerian demonstrators, later imprisoned for crimes against humanity during the Second World War, Maurice Papon. Now, I looked him up, and he was involved in the deportation of Jews to Auschwitz, and that's what they got him for eventually. But he was a tricky customer, and when the Nazis were defeated, he suddenly turned around and became a fervent supporter of de Gaulle, and de Gaulle actually protected him for a lot of, because there were calls for him to be investigated when this Algerian thing happened, but de Gaulle protected him. But eventually, it wasn't until the late 1990s that he was actually put on trial for his activities during the Second World War, and he was sent to prison and almost immediately released because he was very old and ill, and he lived for another 5 to 7 years. So it's just there's a lot of murkiness, and this is a book about murkiness and finding stuff out that possibly it doesn't do you any good to know about, and double crossing. And yeah, and if you're a lover of Robert Goddard, I think this is a book that it's not a quick, easy read, but it's a very absorbing and fascinating read. Yeah.
Thank you.
Okay.
Right, we better let you have a wee rest. Well, everyone will be back to Christine in just a minute and a half.
For more information on the Dunedin Athenaeum and Mechanics Institute, go to www.dunedinathenaeum.org.nz. That's Dunedin, athenaeum.org.nz.
Welcome back.
Now, you know how sometimes you think you know about somebody or people, and then when you read a bit more, you realise, I never knew that. Yes, like with the book, The Mitford Girls, about the Mitford sisters, I thought I knew all about them, but actually there was stuff I knew didn't know about them. Now, I've got this book about how famous authors died, and I sort of bring it in occasionally, and they've got one about Oscar Wilde, and I always thought, I don't think I even bothered to read the chapter because I thought, I know about that. Now, I had a very childish idea that after he was released from jail, he went over to France and almost immediately took to his deathbed, and the famous quote, the wallpaper and I are in a battle to the death and the wallpaper's winning and all that. And to my mind, he sort of died 6 months after he left prison. But no, he lived for a couple of years afterwards, and He went to Paris, and he lived on a small sum that his estranged wife sent him, and he was so he lived in this modest hotel, which he never paid his bills. And she died in 1898, and then from then he relied on friends. A typical day started at 11 o'clock with breakfast, followed by lunch at 2 o'clock, then drinks at the Café de Régence at 5 o'clock, and supper after midnight at the Café de Paris. And so the owner of the hotel supplied him with 5 bottles of cognac each week. And the owner said the litter would hardly last him through the night. So he did write the Ballad of Reading Jail, and he prepared plays for publication. Then he fell ill in October 1990. So 1900. Oh. So he was released in May 1897. So
yeah. Oh, 3 years.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
So it's a bit like he lasted a bit longer than I thought.
I always thought he left prison and sort of died within a few months too. So.
Yeah, I don't know why. I think just because he was never talked about.
I only thought that because you probably told me.
Oh, yeah, blame me. So anyway, he telegraphed his old friend and lover, Robert Ross, terribly weak, please come. And then it took Ross a couple of months to make it to him, and Ross arrived at the end of November, and he found Wilde thin, his flesh livid, his breathing heavily, and with a 2-week growth of beard. So anyway, he died the next day eventually. But really what I want to talk about is his grave, which is in the famous cemetery, which I probably doesn't have a... the Pâté Lachaise Cemetery, which I've actually been to.
Oh, that's impressive.
Yeah, well, I didn't wander around and look at find anyone's, because there's lots of famous graves there. There's Jim Morrison, other people. But anyway, so his friend Ross in 1913 commissioned a sculptor to design a monument, and it's a modernist work which is in the form of a 9-foot nude demi-angel. And it's sort of a brutalist. It almost looks like a Polynesian figure, and it's not standing upright. It's hovering. The plinth is on a big square, and it's hovering over it. And his male genitalia was apparently very eye-catching, and the person in charge of the cemetery insisted that it was covered with plaster. And so then they had the argy-bargy over that because the artist wasn't pleased. And then in the end, they made a compromise where they made a metal butterfly shape and covered the genitalia with this. And then the monument to Wilde was opened, and the sculptor refused to come because he was so offended that his work had been defaced in this way. And yeah, it was immediately stolen, apparently, by Aleister Crowley, the famous spiritualist or devil worshipper. Yeah. Just very, very quickly, in 1961, two English ladies visiting were so offended by the dangling testicles that they hacked them off and took them to the office of the cemetery management and said it was obscene and left it with them when they were used as paperweights, but they have since disappeared. And people have taken it to kissing the statue, the monument.
Yes. Wow.
It's an afterlife.
On that note, happy reading,
yes,
everyone.
Happy reading.
The Dunedin Athenaeum and Mechanics Institute welcomes new members. Enjoy the Athenaeum's quiet, warmly carpeted library and reading room and share in the joy of books, new and old. Visit www.dunedinathenaeum.org.nz for more information, or pop into the Athenaeum Library at number 24, The Octagon. The Dunedin Athenaeum and Mechanics Institute, celebrating Dunedin's rich literary heritage since 1851.
This podcast was produced by ORFM Dunedin with support from New Zealand On the Air.